Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Orlando Science Center, presenting Life, an all-new exhibit on nature and conservation. Animals are the real storytellers of life's three distinct environments: rainforest, ocean, and swamp, with hands-on experiential learning that vividly demonstrates humanity's interconnectedness with the natural world. More at osc.org.
Curious Space and Starliner's first crewed mission. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Kids ask the best questions. That's why we're turning the mic over to young space enthusiasts who want to ask an astronaut their burning questions about space exploration. For our first Curious Space segment, veteran NASA astronaut Winston Scott joins us to field questions from our younger listeners about what it's like to live and work in space. Then, after years of delays, Boeing is prepared to send a crew of two to the International Space Station, where they'll spend about a week before returning to Earth. It's a crucial mission for Boeing to certify Starliner for future crew rotations to the ISS. We'll speak with podcast host Anthony Colangelo about the stakes of this launch. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? We're turning the mic over to some of our younger space enthusiasts with a new segment on Are We There Yet? We're calling Curious Space. My producer and I took a trip to the Orlando Science Center earlier this month during the solar eclipse to ask kids what they want to know about space and what it's like to be an astronaut. We put those questions to veteran NASA astronaut Winston Scott. Here's that conversation. Winston, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you. Glad to be back on the show.
We are going to have so much fun, Winston. So my producer and I, we spent the solar eclipse here in Orlando at the Orlando Science Center, and we asked a lot of the young space enthusiasts to jump into our sound booth and ask some questions for you for this conversation. So without further ado, we're going to jump straight into it with our first question. This comes from Aiden, who was 11 years old.
My question is, how did you become an astronaut?
Aiden, I had to apply to become an astronaut. NASA solicits people to apply, and you have to do that. But before you apply, of course, you have to prepare so that you meet the qualifications. I became an astronaut from the U.S. Navy. I was a naval aviator. So I flew airplanes in the Navy, and then I went into the research, development, testing, evaluation side of naval aviation, which means I got to do the scientific side of flying. And then I applied to NASA and was fortunate enough to get selected. Now, you do not have to come from the military. That's one way you go, Air Force, Navy, Army, or whatever. But many people become astronauts just through civilian life. In that case, of course, you want an advanced degree in some type of STEM subject. STEM means science, technology, engineering, or mathematics. And you want an advanced degree, a master's degree, or what we call a doctorate degree, and research experience. So the key is research. My research was a test pilot in the Navy. Civilians can get research through their company or their university, and then you apply to NASA to become an astronaut.
A follow-up question, Winston. Aiden's 11 years old, so plenty of time for them to become an astronaut. I'm turning 37 this year. Do I stand a chance at becoming an astronaut, or is it too late for me?
No, not at all. In fact, the average age of selection is late 30s. So there are plenty of 37, 38, 39-year-olds who are selected, because by the time you get the experience NASA wants, you're typically mid to late 30s, sometimes older. When I was selected, there were three of us in my class who were 41. And in one case, somebody was selected when they were 50. So again, experience and education will take you up in this. So no, it's not too late. In fact, you should have applied. They just had to cut off.
A little too late. I just missed it. Well, I'll leave it to the young people like Aiden to apply instead. So, Winston, we had a lot of questions about what it's like to kind of live and work in space. So this one comes from Skyla, who's 4 years old.
What do astronauts eat?
Yeah, that's a good question. Skyla, I can tell, is a rather bright person. We eat the same things in orbit that you eat on Earth. For example, breakfast, I might have scrambled eggs, sausage patties. I could have hash brown potatoes, or I might decide to have cornflakes and milk. I could drink orange juice, apple juice, tea, or coffee, or whatever. So the same foods you eat on Earth, but they're prepared differently because they are dehydrated. And for those in the audience who don't know what that means, it means that the water has all been removed from the food. So the food is dry, just a dry glob of stuff. Then we have a special galley or kitchen where we rehydrate the food. That is, we re-inject the water into the food, and it'll expand and grow and look and taste like what it's supposed to be. Scrambled eggs or grits or hash browns or whatever. So again, we eat the same things up there that you eat down here, but prepared differently. Now, I always like to ask, for those who are listening, everybody in the audience knows what a Capri Sun is. Well, Capri Suns came from the space program because that's the way we drink our liquids in space. All the liquids are in drink bags, like a Capri Sun. You put a straw in the bag and you sip it. The difference is that when you're done sipping in orbit, you have to close the straw. There's a clip that allows you to close the straw up. Otherwise, the rest of the liquid will float out of the straw and out into the spaceship.
I did not know that about Capri Sun. That is very fun. So now I can practice being an astronaut with my Capri Suns down here on Earth. I love that. All right. Our next one, Winston, comes from Ava, who is 10 years old.
Is sleeping in space comfortable or no?
Sleeping in space is comfortable in that you're very light. You float continuously. But it's uncomfortable because you feel so weird. You cannot actually lie down in space because your body is floating all over the place. So sometimes you may feel as though you're lying on your stomach. You may feel as though you're standing on your head. You may feel as though you just have a weird feeling. In that respect, it's different from sleeping on Earth. When we sleep on Earth, we lie down and we feel as though we're lying on a bed with a pillow under our head. That's very comfortable. When you sort of floating randomly in your sleeping quarters, it's kind of a weird, strange feeling. So comfortable, yes and no. Definitely different.
Winston, is it hard to sleep in space because you're moving so fast and you're seeing so many sunrises and sunsets while you're up there?
Yeah, it adds a level of difficulty because you can't go to bed where you start and get up where it's light because you see 16 darknesses and lightnesses, I guess sunrises and sunsets, every 24-hour period of time. So what we do is we sleep according to a schedule. When it's time to go to bed, we turn the lights down in the room or the shuttle or the station, and we put shades over the windows, and we pretend it's nighttime. For the daytime, we turn the lights up, we remove the shades from the windows, and we pretend it's daytime. But the sun's going up and down and up and down and up and down. So your sleep has to be done according to a timeline.
Very interesting. Winston, our next one comes from Olivia, who is 5 and a half. She wanted to make sure that we knew that she was 5 and a half years old. And I think that you will be able to answer this one because you have done 3 spacewalks yourself.
That's correct.
Here's yeah. Olivia's question.
How does an astronaut get into astronaut suit? Like, do they have a ship or something?
We have to have help getting into our astronaut suits because the suit is so big and so bulky and so heavy. And it actually splits. It comes apart. So the gloves will come off and the top part will separate from the pants. And we have to sort of put our pants on and pull those up. And then we wiggle up into the top part. And then we have to clip them two together. And then we have to have our gloves put on and clipped on and fastened on. And then we get the helmet put on and fastened on and locked in place. We have to have help to do that. One of our crewmates on the space shuttle or space station will help us get the suit put on. And then will help us also to turn the suit on and get it powered up and get it working properly before we go outside. Have to have it working properly because we want to be safe in space.
That sounds like a process there and something that you do need a lot of teamwork for, right? You have to trust your colleagues in space to help you get dressed, right?
You certainly do. You need your colleagues to help you get dressed. And before you go outside, as you gradually take the airlock pressure to zero, you test the suit to be sure it's working properly so that when the airlock gets down to zero and we open the hatch to go out, we want to be sure that suit's working properly.
Mackenzie, who is 7 years old, is going to ask the question that we all have wanted to ask you.
Do you have a bathroom?
Do you have a bathroom?
I knew it. It's yes, indeed, we have a bathroom. And if you see the toilet, you will recognize it. But it's different from your toilet at home. There's no water in it. Water would flow all over the place. So the toilet has a bowl and is connected to similar to a vacuum cleaner. So you turn the fan on, the fan spins up, and you can check to be sure you've got appropriate suction. And then when you use the toilet, the suction will take all of the waste material, the liquid waste, your urine, will be stored in a liquid storage tank, kind of like a septic tank, and the solid will be stored in a separate tank. It's freeze-dried and sort of stored away from the rest of the shuttle, And it's not dumped out into space. When we come back, we bring the solid material back. It's disposed of on Earth the same way you dispose of waste from a bus or a train or an airplane or whatever. If the liquid tank gets too full, we can dump the liquid out into space. But it does not fall to Earth. It won't fall on your head and wake you up. The liquid will dissipate in space. We have to practice using that toilet because we want to use it correctly. And also somebody on the crew has to know how to repair the toilet. Because if it breaks in orbit, you can't call Mr. Rooter, Roto Rooter, or Mr. Plumber to fix it. So somebody has to know how to fix the toilet if it breaks in space. And yeah, toilet is a very, very important part of our equipment on spaceship.
Thank you for answering that. And thank you for Mackenzie for asking the question that we were all too embarrassed to ask. All right. This one comes from Madison, who's 12 years old.
Are you able to see like hurricanes and stuff from space?
Yes, that's a good question. You can see hurricanes and large storms, large weather patterns from space. When we see hurricanes on the news, on the weather on TV, those pictures are taken from space by satellites. Astronauts also take pictures out of the window. If there's a hurricane down there, we can float up to the window and take pictures of it, take movies and other pictures, and beam those pictures back to Earth so that meteorologists can study the hurricanes and learn more about them. You can see thunderstorms from space. If they're large enough and you're on the dark side of the Earth, you look down, way down beneath you, you can see thunderclouds, lightning rippling through the top of the thunderclouds.
Winston, this one comes from Zane, who is 8 years old.
Does space affect your bone density? How long does it take for your bone density to return to normal after returning from space?
Zane is probably going to be a doctor here one of these days. Maybe
it sounds like it, yes.
And the answer is yes. What happens is the weightlessness does affect what we call bone marrow density, blood volume, and calcium. You lose calcium from your bones as well. So a number of things happen to your bones. And your blood volume can return and your muscle mass will return. Blood volume density will return to normal. Your calcium probably will not. Your body will leach, give up so much calcium, and you probably will never regain all the calcium that you lost when you were in space. So if we're going to go off and do long duration missions, for example, we're going to go to the moon and stay for a year, or if we're going to go off to Mars, and that's a 2 or 3 year trip, you know, we have to figure out a way to prevent loss of bone marrow density, calcium, and so on. Now, your question about how long does it take to recover? Well, again, some items will recover, like muscle mass, blood volume, calcium will not recover. You as a person, when you return from space, how long it takes to get back to feeling normal, 100% normal, depends on how long you were up there. I was up for about 2 weeks on one trip, and I could walk immediately, but it was a very careful walk because my balance was thrown off and my muscles got sore because now I'm lifting and carrying my own body weight. So I could walk, but it wasn't a normal walk until a week or so later. And even when I felt normal, I had to be careful because I could still injure myself with stress fractures and so on. How long it takes to get back to 100% normal, it depends on how long you were up there. And some things will never get back to normal, like calcium loss. A long answer to a short question, but that was a really good one from our future Dr. Zane.
Yeah, it was a fascinating question and answer there. All right, I'm saving the best for last because I have to admit, I never had this question before. And now I'm very curious for the answers. This one's from Layla, who's 8 years old.
So where do you blow your nose in space?
Well, Layla, if you're inside the spaceship or in the space station, you blow your nose just like you do on Earth. You have a handkerchief or a tissue. If you're doing a space walk inside of with your helmet on, then you don't have a way to blow your nose. But remember, a sneeze or having to blow your nose is a reaction to some kind of impurity, some type of particle, dust, dirt, or whatever. The air inside of my helmet is so clean that I never have to sneeze or blow my nose. That usually does not become a problem.
We've been speaking with Winston Scott. He is a veteran NASA astronaut who's flown on 2 shuttle missions, 3 EVAs, and no sneezes while he was outside the spaceship. Winston, thank you so much for answering our questions.
It's been my pleasure. It's been fun.
That was veteran NASA astronaut Winston Scott for our first installment of Curious Space. Do you have a young space enthusiast who has a question or two about space exploration? Well, record them with a voice memo and send it to us. We may use it for a future episode. Please be sure to include your first name and age and email it to areweThereYet@cfpublic.org. And big thanks to Orlando Science Center for hosting us at the Eclipse Watch Party earlier this month and letting us bring our mobile recording unit to your science center. Still to come, the stakes are high for Boeing Starliner crew launch next week. We dig into that story. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? After several delays pushed the mission back for years, Boeing's Starliner is now cleared for a crew test flight as early as May 6th. Since the space shuttle's retirement in 2011, SpaceX's Dragon capsule has been the only U.S.-based vehicle to carry crews, launching its first crew in 2020. If all goes as planned, Starliner could be an additional U.S.-based capsule to bring astronauts to the ISS. Here to talk about the importance of this mission is Anthony Colangelo, host of the space podcast Main Engine Cutoff. Anthony, welcome back to the show.
So good to be here as always, Brandon. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, always great to have you, Anthony. And last time we talked about a high-stakes mission with Starship. There's a pretty high-stakes mission coming up with Starliner, right?
I mean, just star-based spaceships.
For star-based names. So yeah, let's talk about the stakes of this Starliner.
Really important mission. Boeing has had a wild run to the launch pad for this one. This is their first crewed flight of this spacecraft. Years late, tons of issues that have delayed them to this point. They've had two uncrewed test flights, one very unsuccessful, one successful, with some discoveries afterwards. But this is important for NASA and their plan of for the ISS generally, which is they really want SpaceX and Boeing to sort of tick-tock between missions up to the ISS so that every 6 months we've got a crew going up to the ISS. They would love both providers to be able to fly these missions. It's especially important if one does run into an issue where they have to have some downtime to work on something, we have the other one to still fly up to the ISS and we don't get into a situation where, you know, once again, Soyuz would be the only way to the ISS. And up till now, that's been the case. If Dragon were to have an issue, we would just have the Soyuz again. Crew size would be quite limited on the ISS for a while. So this dual provider strategy is really the key to the whole commercial crew strategy overall. It has just taken, you know, 4 years for that to develop where we will have both online.
Walk us through some of the issues that have popped up during this program. I know they started back during its first uncrewed mission. What were Boeing engineers dealing with to get to this point?
Yeah, the first uncrewed mission was back in December 2019. It was supposed to go up to the ISS, dock for a couple of days, and then come back successfully. There were a ton of issues. Eventually, they were not able to get to the ISS. They, you know, the biggest one was that the thrusters on the service module were not mapped correctly. So what the command system was trying to do with the spacecraft, it was not actually doing that in real life. It was effectively deorbiting the vehicle, and engineers on the ground caught that and redirected that. So saved the early mission, but they couldn't make it to the ISS successfully. So they had to rework that. It got back down on the ground and they were going to go up again in August of 2021 for a redo of that flight to be able to make it to the ISS successfully. But they had issues with valves on the launch pad. There were more moisture that got in and there were 13 valves, if I remember correctly, that were inoperable. So they had to take that service module back and start working on it. Eventually they realized we just got to get a whole new service module. That's the piece under the crew vehicle. That has all the thrusters and solar panels and all of the useful stuff. So they had to swap that out entirely, which was a big delay to get them back on the launch pad. They eventually did fly in May 2022. And then when they were going to certify, basically get ready for this crewed test flight, there was a bunch of reviews and they found issues, parachutes that needed to be reworked. There were materials issues inside the spacecraft that were actually more flammable than anyone thought, which would have been a real big problem. So they had to rip out, you know, miles and miles of this stuff and rework the materials inside the vehicle to finally get to the launch pad now. So things look good. They've passed the review on the way to launch. And if all goes well, then we'll have another operational vehicle online.
And also during that process of troubleshooting all of those issues, Boeing was also under scrutiny for its leadership, right? I mean, this organization and this program has been under the microscope for years now, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's a rough time to be at Boeing. You know, obviously everyone's aware of the commercial airline drama that's been going on for a long time. They've had tons of issues on that side of the business. On the space side of things, Starliner has been in trouble for a couple of years now. They've had to take a lot of charges, as they call it, like money that Boeing themselves is spending on this program beyond what they had budgeted for. So this has been a pretty big loss financially for the company. And then on the other side of things in the space world, SLS is now working, but that was not an easy path to the launch pad for that vehicle either. And, you know, now we're in a different transition phase for that as well, where Eric Berger at Ars Technica had a report that there's some layoffs coming on the SLS side of things as budgets sort of rework for this new era. Now, that's not entirely unexpected, where we're past the first test flight. We're getting more into sort of production than development. So you would expect people to either be moved to other projects or, you know, just turn the team size turned down or hiring stopping or whatever to sort of get into this very predictable production phase where you're not working on so many different projects. But it is in response to some NASA budget shifting that is not yet public. So we'll see how that develops in the coming years. But I mean, there's just all sorts of turmoil internally at Boeing. And, you know, that probably affects future plans, especially for something like Starliner. It's the one project on the space side of things that ideally would have a commercial application where, you know, we've seen people like Jared Isaacman buying these flights on Dragon for the SpaceX side of things. We haven't seen that yet for Starliner. And really, there are no public plans that would indicate anyone's interested in buying Starliner beyond these NASA missions. Right now, it is kind of just a NASA thing that they are focused on as part of the ISS program. And it doesn't know, I don't know if it's going to go much further than that, which is a bummer for, I think, people that want to see a flourishing of the space industry, but not surprising. I think if you made me bet years ago on how these would turn out, probably would have been something like this.
Well, let's talk about this first crewed mission. As you mentioned, NASA gave Boeing the go-ahead to proceed with launch. What is the goal of this mission, and what can we expect once the spacecraft does leave the ground?
This is identical to the mission that SpaceX flew back in May 2020. It's hard to believe that was 4 years ago, but obviously that was a wild time in the world. So hopefully this is a little bit more chill. I have this whole theory about how, you know, 2024 is sort of like the other end. It's the other end of the Thanos snap of 2020, where it was the same Super Bowl. We have the same presidential election. Apparently we're having the same crewed test flight that's going on. So it feels like everything is kind of reverting to the mean. But the goal here is to prove out Starliner's crew systems. So the environmental control systems, the life support inside the vehicle, make sure that the displays and the controls that the crew has access to functions in space and is functional, meaning that it's easy to use for the crew, it's understandable, and they're able to have full control of the vehicle when they need it. We've already seen Starliner dock to the ISS, so it's, you know, another test of that, but that's not something unproven. But it is at the first time that people will be flying aboard, so there's just a lot that needs to be worked out. The spacesuits, another side of that, they wear these, you know, they're not full-blown spacesuits like you would go on a spacewalk, but they are flight suits that need to be able to handle off-nominal situations if the spacecraft were to depressurize. So there's a handful of crew systems that need to be tested and validated, and then, you know, they'll stay on board for, I think it's about a week, before they then come back down. First time they're testing reentry with the crew as well, so the crew will certainly have reports on comfort, both up and down. They land in the desert, whereas SpaceX lands in the water, which we had done before in the Apollo era. So that's different. It looks more interesting, I think, because White Sands is really cool. So but I'm a sucker for nature, so I guess that's more my thing than anyone else's. But it's really just, you know, giving it a full run of all the things you need for this vehicle to be successful, to take a crew up to the ISS, stay there for a couple of days in this state where, you know, it's just hanging out really, and then being able to return and keep the crew safe the whole time, keep them comfortable the whole time, and be a productive vehicle to get people up and down.
I think something that's been lost a bit on the coverage of Starliner is the rocket that will be taking it, the ULA's Atlas V, which, if I read correctly, it's the first time a human will be on an Atlas rocket since the Mercury program, right?
That is true. I even forgot about that. I mean, that's pretty cool. I think it's interesting in that when you look at the Atlas V overall, you know, this is going to be some of the tail end missions of this vehicle. ULA is now transitioning to Vulcan. They've flown the first flight. Second one should be coming up soon. There's only a certain amount of Atlas V's left, and mostly it's flying humans and a bunch of Amazon satellites. Those are really the two things that Atlas V is tasked with. But it will be interesting to there is a bit of a difference on this Atlas V as well than typical ones. The Centaur upper stage has an additional engine to provide a better trajectory for humans. They can't fly the same way that a payload does, because they need to be cognizant of abort scenarios and being able to get back safely if something goes wrong on the initial ascent. So handful of differences on the vehicle, but I mean, I do love myself an Atlas, so that will be cool. And I think it's unique in this, you know, if my theory is right and there's not a lot of Starliner beyond this, these are, you know, a handful of humans that will fly on this thing on top of an Atlas V with some solid rocket boosters. No one's flown on an Atlas with a solid rocket booster. So there's another milestone. I know space loves these firsts. So that'll be the first astronauts on an Atlas V or an Atlas class vehicle with a solid rocket booster. Someone will get a little plaque made of that.
And I knew I could get you going if I brought up Atlas and Centaur. So
listen, it's awesome.
And finally, Anthony, let's talk a bit about the astronauts, you know, both veteran astronauts. How do they seem getting ready to go on to this is a brand new vehicle? First time they're going to be flying on it. And the first time a female will be commanding a first human flight of a spacecraft as well.
And yeah, I mean, they've both been around in the Corps. This is Butch Wilmore and Suni Williams. They've been around for so long, and not only with NASA generally, but with this mission. They've been, you know, there since the beginning of this program. Early on, NASA assigned certain astronauts to certain vehicles. So they would be kind of giving the crew input as they develop these vehicles. And then it was thought at the time that, you know, obviously these are going to be the first crews that would fly on this vehicle. So there's a huge familiarity that they have with the vehicle, with the team behind it, with the ground crew, a lot of comfort in that. And it's, you know, important because you need to sort of let a lot of your muscle memory work when there's so much going on a mission like this. You need to be familiar enough that a lot of that can go to like background processing and not take your main brain cycles so that you can focus on other things that you need your mind doing. You know, think about when you're driving in your car and you kind of don't even need to look to turn the radio up or to adjust your air conditioning. You just have muscle memory of like where those things are. That is really helpful on the first mission when there's just so much to coordinate. So the fact that they've been following along so long not only gives them that familiarity, but makes them comfortable with what's the current state of the vehicle. This mission doesn't really happen until they have their sign off and the astronaut office as well. So, you know, I think anytime someone is getting in a spaceship, they have been made familiar with the vehicle, and they're comfortable that this is going to be a safe ride for them. And NASA's, you know, the problems that Starliner has had to this point, I think people online talking of like, oh, NASA's going to let Boeing slide because of them being Boeing. But I don't really think that's true. I think all of these issues and the state that's Boeing is in, there's just more pressure on these kind of missions, and not pressure in that they're going to go too early or something like that. But they need to make sure everything is right, because this cannot go wrong in any way. It's a really critical moment for the program overall, and NASA needs this to work out for their own plans as well. So I think, you know, that should give everyone confidence that things are going to go well.
We were with Anthony Colangelo. He is the host of the Main Engine Cutoff podcast and co-host of Off Nominal as well. Anthony, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or even on YouTube these days, or really wherever you get your podcasts. We've got more space coverage online. Visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marian Summerall. Our intern is Emily Ching. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.